Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. House Republicans have unveiled their plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, proposing to scrap the individual mandate and replace it with a tax credit system to entice participation. The plan also would roll back the expansion of Medicaid, a component of Obamacare that has covered more than 10 million Americans in 31 states, including Ohio. Coming up, we'll hear from supporters and critics of the plan, and particularly the issue of Medicaid expansion. Joining us now by phone is political health care reporter Ruchana Pradhan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is far from a done deal, of course, but President Trump in a morning tweet today called the proposal wonderful and new. Is it new?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I would say that generally speaking, what House Republicans unveiled yesterday in very significant parts of the legislation adhere to what they've said they would do in terms of rolling back the ACA's expansion of Medicaid, as you noted, and also tweaking the level of tax credits or subsidies that are available to people who go on the exchanges and purchase health insurance in that way. But there are some changes, some pretty notable ones, actually, compared to sort of the test run that Congress had in 2015 when they drafted a Obamacare repeal bill and they passed it. And, of course, at that time, it was vetoed by then-President Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. How does it differ?
Well, so, for example, at that time, the bill just I believe it was a two-year phase-out of the Medicaid expansion under the law, for example. And it also immediately repealed all of the taxes. There are a bunch of industry taxes in the law that help to pay for the pieces that expanded coverage. But now, this latest bill, for example, on the Medicaid piece in particular, since I know in Ohio, I'm sure this has been the a very big topic of discussion. It does freeze Medicaid expansion enrollment in 2020, but the higher amount of funding that the law includes for states to expand their programs, that is still going to be in effect for the next few years if this legislation were to pass. And it's also technically possible for a state to hold on to that money after 2020, albeit with some big caveats. So that's a pretty big difference from what Congress did in 2015 when they were kind of testing this out.
Senator Rand Paul has already cast aspersion on the proposal. What are his criticisms? Does he have enough of a following to make a difference?
So I think Senator Paul is representative of a small but very vocal group that is saying that this latest bill is just Obamacare light, mm-hmm. and it doesn't do what Congress said they would do, which is completely repeal it. And I think Senator Paul represents a group of lawmakers that is saying we should worry about a replacement later and we should just repeal it now because that's what we promised. There is a following of that theory also in the House of Representatives. I think basically leadership is getting some pushback from the right because they're saying that this bill is not aggressive enough. We said we would repeal the law and that was it. But also you have, from the other side, you have a group of moderates, especially in the Senate, who are saying that actually this bill is too extreme and we don't know if we can go along with it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The GOP-controlled House yesterday revealed its plan to repeal and replace Obamacare, that is the Affordable Care Act. My guest right now, Ruchana Pradhan, she's a healthcare reporter for Politico. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email your questions on All Sides to All Sides at WOSU.org. Yesterday, four Republican senators, including Rob Portman of Ohio, signed a letter saying that the House draft that they have reviewed did not adequately protect states like theirs that have expanded Medicaid under ACA. Is that group that you're talking about, the more moderates that are concerned about their own states?
Right. I think because the Medicaid expansion issue has been one of the biggest sticking points mm-hmm. in this entire debate because we have 31 states, as you mentioned, and the District of Columbia that have expanded their programs to cover more low-income people. Half of those states have Republican governors who, and many of them have been quite vocal about the need to make sure that that does not go away. In Ohio, Governor John Kasich has probably been the most vocal in saying that this needs to be preserved, and Medicaid expansion has been very beneficial to low-income people in your state. Now, so I think they have the ears of a lot of their state delegations in Washington, and so they've been telling their senators that represent their states that I think, you know, we need to be really careful with what happens here. Even beyond a stable transition period, we need to make sure that these people remain covered. And so I think what you're seeing from the Senate especially is just a reflection of what their governors have been saying. And certainly Senator Portman is not the only one. I think the way it looks right now, the House bill as it currently stands is going to have an extremely difficult time making it through the Senate if it just phases out the Medicaid expansion, and there's no guarantee that those people are going to remain covered.
The GOP plan would restrict the Medicaid expansion funding to people who were in the program as of passage, and states would get that amount of federal funding for each participant as long as they remained eligible, under the premise, I guess, that most people on Medicaid drop off after a few years. Is that a fair premise from what you understand, particularly given the state of, even though we're at, like, say, 5% unemployment in Ohio, we still have higher rates of poverty?
Right. So I think one of the biggest things to keep in mind about the pieces of the House bill that deal with Medicaid are, so technically what the legislation says is if you are a Medicaid expansion enrollee and you have been enrolled in the program by 2020,
mm-hmm.
Ohio has been getting a lot more federal money to provide services to those people. So the state will continue to be able to have that money for those grandfathered enrollees unless they have a lapse in coverage. Now, Medicaid enrollees, oftentimes people who have incomes around the poverty line experience a lot of churning and a lot of fluctuations in their income. And the House bill says if you even have a lapse in coverage for as little as 1 month, if you ever go off of Medicaid and then come back in, Ohio is not going to be getting nearly as much federal money to cover those people. So I think most experts that I've talked to so far say that even though in theory the states would be allowed to keep some of that federal funding boost that was available under the ACA after 2020, just because of normal attrition and normal income fluctuations that happen in Medicaid, they expect that most of the people are not going to be covered under that higher federal funding amount in the future. And so that's a very big issue for states because that's going to have a very direct impact on their budgets. It's going to affect their hospitals. It's going to affect their ability, perhaps, to keep providing services to those people. And so the Medicaid issues in this bill are very complex. Mm-hmm. And I think so most people, I think, are still trying to unpack exactly what it means for their states.
The plan also bolsters states that did not choose to expand Medicaid under the ACA. Why that?
Well, I think, frankly, so
for votes.
So, well, I think it's when you look at that, really, it kind of boils down to politics, honestly, because mm-hmm. so we have 19 states that have not expanded Medicaid. Nearly all of them are controlled by Republican governors, and arguably, from a political perspective, they did what many Republicans in Washington probably wanted them to do, which is to not take up a very major part of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, they're making the argument that, well, they can't be punished by getting less money in a future system because they did what the, kind of Republican orthodoxy was at the time, which is to not accept this program.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress is trying to figure out in some ways how to make it equitable so that they do not end up with less federal money than, frankly, a lot of Republican states that adopted Medicaid expansion, but also a ton of states with Democratic governors. They're not going to say when you have Republicans in power in Congress, they're not going to come up with a solution that rewards leaders of the opposite party more than their own colleagues, right? So I think that's a very delicate balance that they have to play, and they have to make sure that they don't, that they being Congress, that mm-hmm. they don't end up pursuing something that would say to Texas or Florida or Georgia, these very conservative states that are quite aligned with them in terms of agenda, and say, sorry, you're going to lose out under this new system.
The proposal would give two popular components of Obamacare, would keep two popular components of Obamacare, I should say. Children could stay on their parents' plan until age 26, and there would be coverage for pre-existing conditions with some caveats. And those caveats are important, I think, but is there any concern about how to pay for all this, given the absence of the individual mandate?
Yes, I would say that that's a very real concern. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, we don't have at this point, we don't have a what is known as a score from the Congressional Budget Office saying, here's how much this is going to cost, and here's how many people would actually be able to stay covered under this House Republican bill. We should have that in the coming days. We don't have it yet, and I don't expect that we're going to have it today. But absolutely, I think supporters of the ACA will argue that in order to have some of these very popular pieces of the law, coverage of pre-existing conditions and letting, no lifetime limits on coverage. Mm-hmm. Those things are very expensive. And in order to have them, you need to have the unpopular piece, that being the individual mandate, so that you spread risk across a broad pool of people. Otherwise, you're going to run the risk that sick people are going to really end up paying a lot more to have insurance, and they may not be able to afford it at all.
And that kind of puts the whole idea on the rails. The House committee has planned votes on the legislation as soon as Wednesday. And without the numbers, how are they even going to vote on it?
Well, I think, you're going to see a lot of ire raised by Democrats for that. Now, I should say, I think estimates for the budget impact and on coverage, is it typical that you would have that from the Congressional Budget Office every time that a committee starts marking up a bill in Congress, which is beginning consideration?
Mm-hmm.
No, not necessarily, but, before it makes it to the House floor for the full chamber to consider it, you would. But I think the concern about this one in particular is because it's such a significant piece of legislation, because the impact on millions of people is could be potentially very significant. I think you'll be seeing a lot of Democrats raising concerns about that. How can they vote on a bill that where they don't even really know what it does?
I read, just getting back to the funding components of this, you mentioned that it repeals the Affordable Care Act taxes on different things, including a 10% sales tax on indoor tanning. Are there other sorts of businesses like that? Is that what you were talking about? And what other sorts of things does it do when it comes to that?
Yeah, there are lots of taxes on industry that were included in the ACA to help pay for the pieces that expand coverage. For example, there's a tax on the medical device industry. There is a tax on insurers that is based on, premiums, basically. There's another tax called the Cadillac tax, which is, I guess it's either a fee or an assessment, whatever you want to call it, on high-cost plans that are offered through employers. All of those things are kind of unpopular among Republicans, and they've always said that they want to undo those taxes. So that, this bill gets rid of most of the taxes. It delays, I think, at least one. The Cadillac tax is maybe delayed. The repeal is delayed until 2025. That's also a big part of this, of this repeal bill, and because Republicans in Congress have been saying that they want to get rid of these taxes for a long time.
Right. But yet again, they're eliminating another funding revenue.
Yes.
Several. And then one more real quick thing. It imposes a one-year funding freeze on Planned Parenthood, and it also prohibits the use of tax credits, which are a major component of the larger bill, to purchase any plan that covers elective abortions.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So the Medicaid, the Planned Parenthood piece, the defunding piece, basically says, right, that Planned Parenthood cannot participate in the Medicaid program for a year. And that is the Medicaid is the largest source of government funding that Planned Parenthood receives.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that could be very significant for them. But kind of going back to the broader politics issue, we've already had one senator, Senator Lisa Murkowski, a couple weeks back. She told her state legislature in a speech that she would not vote for a bill in Congress that eliminates the Medicaid expansion and that defunds Planned Parenthood. Mm. And so even that piece, I don't, you know, it's debatable, I think, whether we'll see it actually stay in the bill, because I think there might be some more moderate senators that have some pretty big reservations about doing that.
Rachana Pradhan, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That's Rachana Pradhan. She's a healthcare reporter for Politico. Coming up, we're going to hear from two sides of the spectrum, different sides of the spectrum, political spectrum, on what we know so far about this proposal released yesterday by House Republicans repealing and replacing Obamacare. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. House Republicans on Monday unveiled their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. House Democrats are already calling the proposed legislation Trump Care. A key component of the measure would eliminate the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act and in favor of a system of tax credits intended to entice participation. And in 2020, the proposal would begin to pair the Medicaid expansion to the states, including Ohio. We're going to get two takes on the GOP plan right now. It's very early in the process. We don't have the numbers. We don't have a lot of the details. But joining us is Executive Director of the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, which supported the Affordable Care Act, Steve Wagner. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.
And by phone, Executive Director of the Portage County Tea Party, Tom Zawistowski. Welcome back, Tom.
Glad to be with you.
Tom, President Trump called the proposal wonderful and new. Do you agree?
Not full-heartedly. You know, those of us, you know, and on the Tea Party side of things, you know, are concerned, you know, about some of the things that aren't going to be repealed. But overall, it's a step in the right direction. And I think people need to understand that this is a step. You know, there's only so much that can be done through this reconciliation process, which is the first step. And there's going to have to be other things that are done down the road, and maybe as far away as 2018, after the 2018 election, that will, you know, do some other things. So, you know, we're like you. We're looking at the bill. We are glad that the individual mandates have been, you know, removed. We are, you know, glad that the penalties are gone, because quite simply, we believe in free markets, and we think, you know, the issue is really the cost of health care, not the availability of health care. You know, and for instance, you mentioned the, you know, the tax credits. I think that's disingenuous. They're not tax credits. The people that are going to get those, most of them, if you know, can't afford, you know, they don't have enough income to have a tax credit, they're a subsidy. We're okay. Call it a subsidy because there are people that need health care. But don't give a tax credit to someone who's making, you know, $300,000 a year. So there's a lot to be discussed about this.
So when we talk in terms of tax credits, are you on the side that says that creates kind of an entitlement, that you don't like the idea of creating a new entitlement?
Well, that's certainly the danger, because our nation's history with entitlements are that they tend to get out of control. So it'll be interesting to see as the debate goes on. And I think that's the other thing that people need to understand. Now this is going to go through a process where our representatives in the House and in the Senate are going to have the ability to make changes to this and to adjust it. And so, you know, what we don't want is a permanent situation. In other words, help people so who can't, you know, get health care to, you know, to get the health care they need, but it's something where they eventually move off into something else because these mandates just bankrupt our nation.
Steve Wagner, final estimates aren't available yet, as we heard from our political reporter a few minutes ago. They're not available yet in terms of how much the plan is going to cost, nor is it clear how many people will lose coverage under this plan. What are you surmising at this point?
I think when we look at how the credits are arranged and how the overall bill is arranged, that you'll see individuals that have low income, low working class people are going to lose coverage. I think older adults are likely not to be able to have their coverage as well. So there might be a shift for younger people, but younger people generally think they're invincible and don't need coverage. I mean, that's been part of the problem of the existing mm-hmm. system. So I'm really concerned that we're going to see a lot of people projected to lose their coverage.
And the political reporter referred to the churn issue, that when you have people living on the borderline of poverty, in and out of that eligibility thing, that's an issue.
Yeah, people are trying to make their lives better. You know, the people in the expansion population, a lot of them have jobs. When they can get more work, when they can get a better job, they're going to move out of that area where they have are eligible for Medicaid. Sometimes then they lose their job and drop back down. Happens pretty frequently in that low-income population.
Tom Zawistowski, are you comfortable with the proposed endurance of Medicaid expansion as proposed by the Republicans in the House?
We're really not. You know, I think Steve is right about, you know, you've got to look at the churn issue and people who drop in and drop out. And what we're excited about, and I spoke with Speaker Cliff Rosenberg from the Ohio House a couple weeks ago about this issue, and he was really talking about, you know, having block granted, you know, Medicaid money so that we can maybe, you know, have some state solutions to this stuff. And I'm pretty excited about that, because I think that, you know, each state really has to look at those populations and provide a safety net. And so, you know, I'm hoping we move to that, not Medicaid expansion, because mm-hmm. remember, people forgot that expansion, that the federal funding for that was going to be reduced, and it's going to start to fall on the state. So if it's going to fall on the state, let's have a state solution for that.
But that block grant approach is not part of the current legislation, right?
Right, and we're going to push for that. I mean, we just don't want the federal government, you know, really, you know, mandating anything. We would rather have it in the hands of the people at our state who know our people, know our problems, and can help fix it. So we'll see how that debate goes, but that would make us feel a lot more comfortable.
Steve Wagner?
Yeah, I think that I do appreciate that we have to figure out how to make sure we provide coverage for people that really are struggling in terms of making ends meet. I think that Governor Kasich, for example, has used a lot of the things that exist today to try and create value in terms of the health care that's provided. And there's a lot of flexibility right now in terms of the waiver structure that exists. The danger in what they're proposing now is they're moving it from being something that is a certainty in terms of the amount of funds that the state would get from the federal government to something that is susceptible to every budget cycle that Congress has, that they can cut it. So they set a per capita cap. Every budget cycle, they can renegotiate what that cap is in terms of how much money they're going to give to Medicaid enrollees.
When it comes to health care, the cost of health care, Tom Zawistowski, Steve Wagner makes a good point. It's kind of like education. Being able to plan ahead and know what's coming is a big function.
Well, that there's no doubt about that. But let's focus on the real issue. And the real issue is the cost of health care. That's what is killing us. That's why Obamacare ran into so much trouble, right? Because, you know, at this point, we're seeing that 40% of health care costs is administrative. And so what we're excited about is the idea of actually getting more bang for our bucks. Those Medicaid dollars will go a lot further if we can have free market competition. For instance, you know, and it's not going to be in this bill, because you can't do it through reconciliation, but in the future bills, this idea of having competition across state lines, you know, where we can buy the insurance we really want, getting rid of these mandates. Our goal in the Liberty Movement is to get the cost of health care down to something reasonable that people can afford, because guess what? If you can't afford it, the government can't afford it. Because guess what? The only money the government has is your money. So we need to get the cost down through competition.
And the competition issue across state lines, that's not part of this legislation, however.
It can't be, right?
But you also want states to be able to do what they want to do. And how what's the roadmap for insurance companies in doing interstate transactions when they're trying to cover plans that are different in every state? Tom?
Well, you know, that's the problem is that, you know, they're doing it as like a community or on a state. You know, in the Obamacare program, they were looking at, you know, rating people based on a community concept. What originally insurance was about is actuarial tables about your health care based on your, you know, family history, et cetera. So we think that that's going to bring efficiency. Even though there's going to be different needs in different states, we think that the insurance companies are going to be able to be much more efficient in this, and basically the consumer, like Steve mentioned, young people. You know, young people are going to buy only the insurance they need, and it's going to be very cheap because they don't need a lot of insurance. They basically catastrophic.
But insurance is not premised on what the individual needs. It's premised on spreading the risk.
Without doubt. And so when you have things like saying, all right, we're going to let you stay on your parents' policy till you're 26, which seems to be that's going to happen. When you have things that say we're going to have a risk pool for existing conditions, all right, that's a way of spreading the risk, not just in that company, but across companies. But the point is to give incentives for people to help lower the cost by choosing plans that fit their specific needs. And we're doomed. We will never be able to pay for whatever health care people want. And that's been what we've seen across the world in other countries that have tried this.
Steve Wagner, from where you sit, Executive Director of Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, is there any way to determine at this point, and it really is early in the Obamacare process, what it's done to change the matrix of health care in the United States, or at least in Ohio?
Yeah. What I hear being advocated is to tear everything apart into tiny little risk pools. Here's our healthy young adults. Here's our young parents. Here's whatever. What is it that they need? But that isn't what helps to spread the risk. That isn't what helps to make health care available for all. It segregates people into higher risk pools where they have to be the ones who are in a pool with people with diabetes, with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, that had cancer as a child. Those individuals then are going to end up having to pay for products that are much more expensive than other people are going to have to
pay. Insurance products.
Insurance products. And that's going to make it unaffordable for them. And that's what the ACA helped to do. It leveled the playing fields by age. It leveled the playing field by gender. It used to be that women could be charged more. We don't want to return to a state where we're seeing people charge more just because of who they are and what they're, you know, what they need in terms of health care.
Tom Zawistowski, I mean, a lot of people say there's going to be winners and losers with anything like this. Do you agree, or do you think everybody can be a winner?
Oh, no, we definitely disagree with that. We think everybody can be a winner. We think that, you know, our nation is based on individual liberty and freedom. And if you are a person, I mean, I am not in the best shape in the world. And if you're a fitness person, you run, you have a good body index, things like that, you shouldn't have to pay what I pay for insurance. My lifestyle is my responsibility. Now, there are people that have genetic disorders and things of that nature, and that's going to factor into this. But our belief is that the best way for everyone to win is to make healthcare affordable, and it's not. And so if you don't have competition, you're not going to drive down costs by the government saying you can only charge this for this pill because there will be no innovation. And that's the dichotomy we're in. So Steve makes some valid points, but I think he can concede that, you know, I make some valid points. The only way we've ever seen to get better service for less money is through competition. So we're for a competitive free market model because we think everybody wins.
Yeah, I don't agree that the only way to to decrease cost is through competition, and do believe that regulation serves an important purpose in terms of defining how the market works. And healthcare is not a great market to be talking about this anyway, because price is very untransparent. You can't tell what you're paying for necessarily. You don't know what you're going to need to expend on it. But in the end, this bill that's been proposed is not making things more affordable. It's making them less affordable for people that live at low income, for people who are older. And so it's not doing anything to make it cheaper for them. If an older adult is only getting two times as much of a tax credit, but they can end up having to pay now seven times or more in terms of their insurance that they're getting, then that's not more affordable for them.
Yeah, it allows insurers to charge their oldest customers up to five times what they charge young adults. The Affordable Care Act limits that to three times. There's a lot of details like that to iron out, right, Tom Zawistowski? I mean, there's a lot of work to do, as you said.
Well, I agree. And I think that, you know, Steve's point is well taken. And so we need to solve those problems. But his point about transparency may be the most important point we've made in this conversation. When I was a young man and I left my family's, you know, home and got my own insurance, when I got sick or went to the hospital, they sent me the bill. I had to send it to my insurance company, who paid their 80%. I wrote a check for my 20%, and I paid it. If we go back to that system, I guarantee you health costs will go down, because I, as a consumer, will say, I don't even want to spend that 20% for this procedure. I'll put it off or I'll wait. That's the problem. There's no transparency. There's a reason for that, because that's how you can bloat the system. And what we'll be pushing for is for Congress to make it, you know, where you have to be able to show me what it's going to cost before I approve any procedure. That's the insanity of this, because you think somebody else is paying for it, but we're all paying for it. That's not fair to anyone.
Well, Tom Zawistowski, Executive Director of the Portage County Tea Party, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thanks, Steve, for being on with me.
Thank you, sir.
Right, Steve Wagner, Executive Director of the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio. Steve, lots more to talk about. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
More conversation on efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act in Congress. The House Republicans unveiled their plan. They are going to be scheduling votes in committees as early as Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the Republican proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The House on Monday unveiled its plan, which would replace the individual mandate with income-based tax credits to incentivize participation. Joining us now is President of the Nonpartisan Nonprofit Health Policy Institute of Ohio, Amy Rowling McGee. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for the invitation to join you today.
What's the effect on financing this deal without the personal mandate for participation?
I think it'll be interesting to see how the CBO scores.
The Congressional Budget Office.
The Congressional Budget Office scores the piece of legislation that was just made public last night, because that'll tell us how much this new proposal will cost. And it will also tell us how many people are estimated to get coverage. I think that not having the individual mandate or some other mechanism to encourage people to have insurance will have an impact on both of those aspects of the CBO estimates.
Are you expecting a lot of people will just drop off without the mandate? Is that what you understand from your research?
Well, I think it's also important to know that the mandate itself wasn't as stringent as some would have liked in the first mm-hmm. place. And we saw that in the numbers, that in Ohio, only a little over 200,000 people got coverage through the marketplace. Mm-hmm. It was not a large number, especially compared to the number of people who got coverage. Over 700,000 Ohioans got coverage because of the expanded
and
Medicaid eligibility levels. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So it didn't have as much of an impact in Ohio, that requirement that people get coverage, as it might have had elsewhere.
Is Ohio a special state or is it a typical state? What do we know about the impact of Obamacare on Ohio?
So we know that in Ohio, the impact of the Affordable Care Act and the decision to expand Medicaid eligibility levels had an impact on access. We recently put out our 2017 Health Value Dashboard, which is available on our website, www.hpio.net. And we found that Ohio performs very well on access to care. We rank 17th compared to other states in the District of Columbia. It's important in particular to know that we saw improvements in our state on a metric related to inability to see a doctor because of cost.
Uh-huh.
We rank 13th on this particular metric,
okay, so
with
if
one
I,
being good.
So there's two there's if I have Medicaid coverage, mm-hmm. it's not always easy to see a doctor, but it's still easier to see a doctor if you have coverage
right.
than it is to see a doctor without it.
Right. So in Ohio, we saw big improvements in terms of the number of people who were going without insurance, but we also saw improvements in terms of people's ability to access care with that card. Because that was one of the concerns originally, is that giving people access to insurance might not translate into actually being able to get care.
Right.
And we did see improvements in our state on that, on those metrics.
Is it too soon to say whether or not people are quote-unquote healthier since the enactment of the
yes.
Affordable Care Act?
So it's important to know that our health is influenced by a number of factors
right.
that are changeable or modifiable. Non-clinical factors like our social and economic environment, our physical environment, our behaviors, the choices that we make, influence about 80% of our overall health. So that's factors like whether we have a decent job, whether we have a quality education, clean drinking water or safe drinking water, nutritious food to eat, those kind of things. As well as
stress.
And stress, exactly. Stress is an important component of that. And then our behaviors. So whether we're getting adequate physical activity or eating well, smoking is an important contributor. So clinical care, meaning access to care and quality of care, only contributes about 20% of our overall health outcomes. So if you're sick, if you experience an accident or injury, if you have a chronic health condition, clinical care is critically important. But that alone is not going to translate into overall population health outcomes. And we've seen that in our state. We're not doing well on our overall population health. So we like to say that access to care is necessary, but not sufficient to achieving positive health outcomes.
There is one issue in particular I wanted to talk with you about, and that is the GO plan would restrict Medicaid expansion funding to people who were in the program as of passage. So it would mm-hmm. grandfather in everybody mm-hmm. who's in it by 2020.
Mm-hmm.
States would get that amount of federal funding for each participant as long as they remain eligible. But in that population, and we talked about it earlier, but I want mm-hmm. you to talk about it some more. In that population, the Medicaid eligible, the Medicaid expansion eligible mm-hmm. population, there's a lot of what we call churn. Mm-hmm. They're in and out of it. It's mm-hmm. not like a constant thing, and then you drop off, you get that great job that has insurance, and life is good.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the income level of people who
yeah.
are getting coverage. So for a family of four, it's around $38,000 a year is the kind of the upper threshold under which you can get Medicaid coverage. So if you think about a family of four with income of $38,000, you think about how, you know, that's likely low wage work
uh-huh.
that can change. You know, you can lose a job easily. You might be piecemealing together several part-time jobs, and your income could fluctuate quite a bit. You know, perhaps you have to take some time off to take care of a sick child or a sick relative. So the life circumstances of people who are living with on very little income can change quite a bit. And, you know, the idea, too, one other provision that was in the bill released last night is 6-month redetermination. So requiring people to come back in and redetermine their Medicaid eligibility every 6 months. When you think about all of the stressors that are, you know, in a person with lower income's life, and adding one more thing, you know, going in or filling out paperwork and whatever the process ends up looking like, is another barrier to getting that coverage.
And even if, like, some, you know, one thing about jobs that do offer insurance coverage. Mm-hmm. For low-wage earners mm-hmm. that maybe have access to something mm-hmm. like that, it's usually priced pretty expensively. They can't necessarily afford it. We still pay premiums
right.
here at Ohio State.
Well, many of those jobs, the low-wage jobs, don't offer any
right.
health insurance, even to full-time workers, let alone part-time
right.
workers. But when it is offered, it is often out of the reach of people living at that income level.
And the issue of allowing insurance companies to offer plans across state lines. Mm-hmm. We talked about that earlier, mm-hmm. that if you're going to let different states have different plans, mm-hmm. you know, required in the state, you know, leave it up to the states what's required in an insurance plan. How do insurance companies navigate that kind of a 50-state system?
I think that they wouldn't. I mean,
there's no advantage to them then.
Right, right. I mean, you either need to take away some of the authority that's been granted to states to regulate their own insurance markets,
right?
Which I don't think folks at the federal level are inclined to do, or it just doesn't have much of an impact at all because it's very difficult. Those insurers have to have provider networks wherever they're offering coverage. And that's really the challenge there.
That's the hospital, you know, systems. That
right,
kind of
exactly.
Thing,
they need to have providers who have agreed to take their insurance plans and, you know, and bill. And that is an additional barrier to this idea of offering coverage across state lines.
Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hello. How are you doing, Ann?
Pretty good, thanks. Well,
me personally, I'm really concerned about this repeal and replace thing. I'm on the Medicaid expansion, and my employment is kind of sporadic. Sometimes I get employed, sometimes I don't. So I'm personally concerned about like getting hired and then getting laid off and then having to come back on the Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
As far as family members, I'm really glad to hear that they're getting rid of the individual mandate because I have family members who make a little bit above minimum wage, so they don't afford, can't get on Medicaid expansion, but they can't afford the deductibles and the premiums on the marketplace or anything else like that. So they're kind of like, we're just going to go without and use our income tax check to pay for the fee.
The fine, if you don't,
yeah.
if you don't participate.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Robert, speaking for yourself personally, what did you do before the Affordable Care Act?
Before I didn't have health insurance.
Okay.
Before that, I was in the military, so
okay.
I had that, and then before that, I was a minor, so I fell under the whole minor.
Okay. Yeah, but just I was meaning immediately beforehand, and. Do you pay anything?
As far on the Medicaid expansion? No.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So he's worried that he might fall off of it. And Robert, one of the concerns is that this proposal doesn't address the churn of people at the Medicaid level, particularly at the expansion level. Do you fall in and out of the Medicaid expansion eligibility, or are you pretty consistently in it?
Well, I mean, I fall in and out of it.
Okay.
It's like sort of if I get employment, it's like if you get employment at state minimum wage
mm-hmm.
and then you make 20 plus hours a week,
Yeah.
You pretty much are ineligible, so you fall out of it. So
okay.
In and out.
Well, good luck. I'm sure, you know, probably hear from you again in the future. Keep us posted on how it's going, Robert. He's a classic example.
Mm-hmm. He is. I think that's exactly the kind of person that I had in mind when I was responding to the question earlier, you know, how difficult it is sometimes to hold on to steady jobs, and especially jobs that have benefits associated with them.
What's the concern about changing the pre-existing contingent component of this? It's kind of not real clear what they're going to do yet. What do you know about that?
Now, I have to say that I haven't looked at the draft bill in detail, so I can't really comment on that question.
What's the importance of that pre-existing condition?
Well, I know from my own personal experience several years ago, you know, before all of this, I was working in a very small nonprofit organization. I was the only staff, and I had to go out and buy my own insurance. And I had what I thought was a very minor pre-existing condition, you know, nothing extremely serious. I had the most difficult time getting any plan at all. I mean, any insurance company to offer me a plan at any price. Finally, I was able to find a plan that was relatively affordable. I mean, I think at the time it was between $300 or $400, which, you know, for a lot of folks, that's still not affordable. And that was over 10 years ago. So I do understand firsthand how even a minor pre-existing condition could keep people from being able to get coverage in the past, and how important it is to keep that provision in the future.
The proposal would allow insurers to charge their oldest customers up to five times mm-hmm. what they charge young adults. And the logic is obvious. It's the older you get, the more likelihood you're going to have illnesses. But the Affordable Care Act limits that to three times. What's the magic in that? I mean, three times, some people might say that's already too much. Now they're saying it limits it to five times. Does that just go down to the fact of spreading the risk, and you have to spread the risk?
Exactly. And then I think it ends up also, I think the idea is that it gets more young people into the pools in the first place, brings mm-hmm. down the cost for them. But the concern, as Steve articulated earlier, is what does that mean for those folks who are in the older end of the spectrum, you know, in the 50 to 64 age range.
Mm-hmm. Pre-Medicare.
Exactly. Who have lower incomes. Are they going to be able to afford plans?
What are you looking at? I mean, the committees are going to mm-hmm. vote on this stuff tomorrow, I guess. I don't know how they do that when they've only had it for a day. But, you know, they're smarter than I am, obviously. But what are you paying attention to? What matters when it comes to what you do?
I think paying attention to those Medicaid provisions and looking at what those will mean. As I mentioned earlier, we have over 700,000 people in our state who've gotten coverage because of those new eligibility levels. Over a quarter of all Ohioans are on Medicaid as a source of payment for the healthcare services that they need. So any provisions that impact that program will be of concern or interest to mm-hmm. our organization. I also just kind of wanted to go back to the fact that we have seen improvements in our state in access to care.
More people are getting care.
Exactly. And I think, you know, building on those improvements is important to achieving overall population health outcomes. You know, I also mentioned that as it stands right now, we're not doing well on our overall health outcomes in our state. And there could be several reasons for this. One, it could take several years to see, you know, people being able to get access translate into good health outcomes overall. A second reason is that, as I mentioned earlier, access to care is necessary but not sufficient to achieving good overall health. But the third, and I think Steve also referenced this earlier, is that there have been efforts underway in our state that are really just getting off the ground to pay for value instead of just volume mm-hmm. of services. And, you know, this idea that if we focused on preventing type 2 diabetes, for example, so that it would be much less costly and more effective than treating type 2 diabetes once it's occurred. If we focus on providing smoking cessation services rather than treating all of the bad effects of smoking, these would be much more effective uses of resources.
Amy Rowling McGee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks
for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.